Golf Smarter, number 597, is brought to you by Radio Baseball Cards. If you're a fan of baseball, or specifically of baseball history, you're going to love our new podcast from smarterpodcasts.com. This week's episode features one of the all-time great ambassadors to baseball and a pretty good manager for the Los Angeles Dodgers over 20 years. But when the topic of Tommy Lasorda's pitching career comes up, he's still bitter about being sent down to the minors by Brooklyn in 1955. Well, then you realize who replaced him in the starting rotation, and it's easy to understand why they made the move. Find Radio Baseball Cards at smarterpodcasts.com or subscribe for free and get each new episode delivered automatically from iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, Overcast, SoundCloud, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. What it takes to run the 2017 U.S. Women's USGA Amateur Championship with Dean Knuth.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Dean.
Thank you, Fred. Great to be back.
It's great to talk to you again. How are things going at Knuth Golf?
Things are going well. We just won another award, Best Product, at the International Network of Golf 2 weeks ago. They had their spring meeting at the World Golf Hall of Fame Village, and so we're on the board again. So it's great.
That's awesome.
It was for our Medalwitz this time.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I was frustrated that I couldn't make it this year. First of all, it was all the way across the country, which makes it hard for me, but also it was a week that I was already, we had travel plans, so I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that it went well for you.
Good event with a lot of good meetings and made a lot of good contacts, so that
awesome.
Was great.
Awesome. And so what's happening product-wise with Knuth Golf?
We now have a full line of metal woods, driver, 3-wood, 5-wood, 7-wood. And then hybrids, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Wow.
And they're all the fairways and hybrids are all titanium faced, which the major brands only have steel.
Uh-huh.
So they're hot and more forgiving than steel. So much larger sweet spot and better dispersion.
Unbelievable. From what I remember in talking to you originally, you had retired. This was just a fun little project to create a driver that anybody can hit. Any amateur can get it off the ground. Seems like it's taken a little more than you thought.
Yeah, it is. It's taking a lot of time, too. Success is a double-edged sword.
Well, I love hearing the word success in the middle of that. Congratulations to both you and Steve on this. That's great.
Thank you.
But that's not why we have you on the show this week. Very interesting. You and I were communicating about this, and you told me what you were doing, and I thought, okay, this is something I have no clue about and I think would be very interesting to me, which means hopefully other people will find it interesting as well. But you are the general chairman of the 2017 U.S. Women's Amateur Championship, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's going to be at San Diego Country Club on August 7th to the 13th.
Uh-huh. Oh, and what does it mean to be the general chairman of this event?
Well, we have we'll have a team of about 300 volunteers, and the general chairman is in charge of all the chairs of all the different committees, making sure that we do everything that makes it a great championship.
Hmm.
So by having it at San Diego Country Club, there's a lot of history because San Diego Country Club was first formed in 1897. And this championship, the USGA's U.S. Women's Amateur Championship, has been played since 1895.
Wow.
This is the 117th championship, and it's going to be played at our club. It is one of the original three USGA championships. The the men's amateur, the women's amateur, were both played in 1895. And then the USGA threw in another event that was mostly caddies called the U.S. Open, which is now a very big deal.
Yeah, you think so? we're recording this the week of the U.S. Open, so we can't talk about the 2017 results. So, sorry.
No, we can't.
But we can predict.
But our club hosted the 1964 U.S. Women's Open, and the which is won by Mickey Wright, and then the 1993 U.S. Women's Amateur, which was won by Jill McGill. So we're looking to have another exciting event in August. It'll be on Fox Sports.
Oh, it's going to be on Fox Sports. And this is a USGA-sanctioned event?
Yes, it is. It's actually, they're in charge of it. We give them our golf course for 9 days.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And a lot of our members are going to be volunteering, and they're helping. But for those that aren't, we have set up reciprocal golf for them at other golf courses in the area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Tell me what, I'm really curious about all of this. How does it work? Well, first of all, you talked about your chair of all the committees. How many committees do you have?
I think we have 27 committees, and in the U.S. Open, there are thousands of volunteers, but in an amateur event, typically 300. The slide that I have, it says that the 156 best amateurs in the world come and play, and there are players who are exempt because of their great play, but over 1,300 players typically enter USGA qualifying, and they come from about 15 countries, and they practice on the course on the 5th and the 6th of August, and then stroke play the 7th and 8th, and then they go into match play on Wednesday, the 9th of August, for the low 64. And so then Thursday and Saturday, they play down the final two players. And then Sunday on August 13th is a 36-hole final. So to determine the national champion. So if you have to play a lot of golf and be in pretty good shape if you're going to make it all the way to the end.
Yeah.
And it's fairly recent champions were like Lydia Ko, who became number one in the world on the LPGA at age 17. I think she just dropped a second place in the world, but she was number one for quite a long time. And it is broadcast live on Fox Sports Wednesday through Sunday, 3 hours a day, and they bring their whole camera crew out.
Wow. So they're not going to be doing the final 36 holes. They'll just do the last couple, for 3 hours on
they're
Sunday.
They're doing they're doing the last 5 days. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Yeah, but on the Sunday championship, 36 holes. They're not going to broadcast all 36 holes.
They put on the USGA.org website, they live stream a couple hours of the morning, and then it's live on the air in the afternoon, like from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., and that catches the second 18. Mm-hmm. And to be on TV. So we've really depended on the San Diego community to help us. This slide says that we need 300 volunteers that week, and we have 240 so far, which is great. We need 40 host families for players that want to stay in private homes instead of at a hotel. And we have 33 so far. That have volunteered from our club, and we need 40 caddies, and we've pretty much got that.
Yeah,
and we have a big off-site parking lot players have to be shuttled to.
Yeah, the host family. So obviously, these are amateur golfers. It's not like they have the money to go spend on these hotels. They need a little bit of love from the local community to open up their homes. Right? What is in it for a host family? What do they get out of it?
Yeah, actually, the host families historically have enjoyed that experience because these players are good golfers. They're self-assured. They're really nice people, and most of them can beat most amateurs in golf, they're really good players too. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an experience to host them, and you know they'll say if they have certain eating requirements or if they're allergic to pets or whatever. But we get people paired up. We're going to host in our house. We've asked to host a player and a parent, because a lot of the players, the younger players, will come with a parent who actually caddies for them as well. So,
oh, interesting.
We think that would be, it'll be a fun experience.
For the parent or for the golfer?
Well, for us. Just
yeah,
to,
right.
You know, just to get to know them.
Right.
So, yeah.
Is it free to the public? Is it free to the public to come out?
Oh, yeah. It's free admission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's free shuttle transportation. It's right near Highway 5, and we just shuttle constantly back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so we'll get thousands of people out watching it as well. So
cool.
It'd be really fun.
Yeah. I'm curious that... you know, it's free to get in. These women who are playing, they get, they don't win a financial prize.
It's right.
Right? They get a cup. But you guys must have a tremendous amount of expenses to put this thing on.
We do. Actually, I've got a slide here, our major budget items. And this is pretty typical for a USGA championship, for an amateur event. Be much more for professional events, but we're going to be spending, our biggest item is transportation, about $48,000, printing and publications, $35,000, site preparation, $30,000, a lot of things. We had a fundraiser day with Nancy Lopez, which is wonderful.
Wow.
For our corporate donors, and that was great. We conduct a hosted dinner on Sunday night, the 6th of August, for all the players, all the USGA officials, and all the corporate donors and others. And so it's going to be a party for about 400, and that's going to be pretty expensive. We are building a 48-foot scoreboard by the USGA specs.
Wow.
And we have to have security and the local police department.
Sure.
For tents and other rentals, portalets out on the golf course, office trailers, and we all give a gift to the players. And so it all adds up to about $650,000.
Wow.
For us to run the event.
And who pays
and so,
that money? Where does that money come from?
Well, most of it has come from either corporate donors or from the members of the San Diego Country Club. So we've raised about $200,000 for corporate donors, and from the membership.
And this is as of the recording, which is mid-June.
We're nearly finished with fundraising, so it's not going to change much.
Mm-hmm.
We created a women's amateur host committee.
Mm-hmm.
Chaired by two very powerful and wonderful business leaders in San Diego. Deborah Reed, who's the CEO of Sempra Energy, is co-chaired with Linda Lang, who just retired as CEO of Jack in the Box, which is a big chain. Mm-hmm. And they brought in lots of people who are leaders in the business community, and brought forward our corporate donations, and so we looked for $650,000 total. We've raised $900,000.
Wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. And the remainder, the difference between $650,000 and $900,000, will be going to two major junior golf charities. The first is the First Tee of San Diego. Which works with inner city kids. So it's a lot more about character building and keeping kids off the street than it is for teaching them golf, although they do learn golf and they become quite good at it. And our other recipient is the Southern California Golf Association Junior Foundation, mm-hmm. Which until this year we used to be called Youth on Course. I think up in Northern California they still call it Youth on Course. Mm-hmm. And so it's turning out to be wonderful all the way around with the help of these two wonderful ladies. We got all the donations that we needed. And I've got a slide here that shows a summary of our major donors. So the gold band there shows where a lot of the money came from, the platinum level donors, and they were $50,000 or more. And then Sharp Reed Steely or Sharp Healthcare is on that list. And they not only gave us some cash, but they also are providing all the doctors and nurses for the medical tent during the event. So they're really terrific.
Yeah, that's very
the
generous.
The County of San Diego's, I'm sorry?
I'm saying it's very generous to give up people's time,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. And a lot of other terrific people that donated. And then we even got some cash from the USGA's major partners, which are American Express, Lexus, Deloitte, and Rolex.
Very nice.
So those four companies also gave us a donation as well.
Can I ask a little side question here, since this is a USGA event, and they also do professional events where there's cash prizes. Where does that money come from the cash prizes? It's not through sponsorships and donations, I would think.
Oh, well, there's a lot of money that comes in at a major professional event like the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. Senior Open and the Women's Open, and it's kind of in that order, the amount of cash that comes in, but there's a lot of tents from supporters that, you know, bring their best clients out to the events that raises a lot of money. So they get quite a bit in television revenue from their Fox Sports contract. So it's on a larger scale. It's a lot more money coming in for the professional events than the amateur events. So the amateur events are just really a lot about giving back to the game, and it's really just a great experience to have a big championship at your golf club and seeing it on TV.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Dean has, and this is a note to you, the listener, Dean has referred to the slide multiple times. If you're listening to the audio of this podcast, then you're not exactly sure what he's talking about. But if you go to Golf Smarter TV on YouTube, you'll be able to see the video, and the slides will correspond. We'll put the slides up to correspond what Dean's talking about. So,
great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's youtube.com/golfsmartertv, where you're also going to find a lot of other reviews on travel, equipment, and even a lot of the Golf Smarter podcast interviews. So now you've had some pretty impressive women that have come through the amateur championship that ended up going in, becoming professional golfers.
Yes. You know, one of the, you know, there's been great players over the decades. The announcer for Fox Sports during the Women's Am, and is also during some of their other championships, is Julie Inkster. And Julie Inkster, before she turned professional, won the U.S. Women's Amateur 3 times in a row.
Wow.
3 years in a row, which is pretty darn impressive. And there have been, you know, many great players over the years that have won it, and some great players over the years who almost won it but didn't, and yet had an incredible professional golf career. An example is Mickey Wright. I think was medalist in the stroke play portion of the U.S. Women's Amateur. She had won the USGA Junior Championship, the girls' junior, and but didn't win, And then she turned pro and had an incredible career with a record number of wins and four U.S. Women's Opens. And another player was Nancy Lopez, who's World Golf Hall of Fame, as Mickey Wright is. And she won the USGA Girls Junior Championship, but did not win the Women's Amateur, and then turned pro out of, I think she was at Tulsa, and turned pro and had a wonderful Hall of Fame career, but didn't win the Women's Open. So it really is a great group of players that do win. Like the last time our club, San Diego Country Club, hosted was 1993, and that was won by Jill McGill, and Jill McGill had a pretty good career on the LPGA, and then retired to raise children, which she has a couple really cute kids, and she's still a really good golfer.
When did amateur golf kind of lose its status? Wasn't there a time where amateur golf was just as popular, if not more popular, than professional golf? I guess before TV coverage or sponsorship dollars, things like that.
Yeah, in the early days, it was much, much more prestigious to win the U.S. men's amateur or the U.S. women's amateur than it was to win the U.S. Open. Yeah, I think a lot of money came from and changed a lot of that due to television. But, you know, certainly Arnold Palmer made professional golf very popular. Our club was the home club of Billy Casper, and he was probably one of the big four. He passed away, but he had a great career and won two U.S. Opens and also won the Masters in 1970. So there were a lot of players that contributed to the growth of the professional sport, but it was amateur golf that was really the big thing, you know, back in the day. Bobby Jones is one of the most famous amateurs who never turned professional, and he won many majors when you include his amateur titles, and he did the unthinkable. In 1930, he won the U.S. Amateur Championship, the British Amateur Championship, which they call the Amateur, and the British Open, which they call the Open, and the U.S. Open, all in the same year, 1930.
Wow!
And that was such unthinkable that anybody could ever do that. And he was given a ticker tape parade through the streets of New York after his fourth major victory, and he never turned professional. He had the opportunity to do that, and it was thought that those amateur events were the pinnacle of the sport, and the professional events, yeah, they were important, but they weren't as important as the amateur events back then.
Yeah, in those days, mostly the guys who were pros were just club pros, right? And they would just be given lessons,
yeah,
and going from event to event just to say that they played an event, let alone win it. But yeah, I thought it was Bobby Jones who dominated the entire sport and never went pro. It's even hard to fathom in 2017 that somebody that would dominate a sport and not be a professional at it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Tell me about the layout of the San Diego Country Club. And what these women can expect.
It's really it's a hidden gem because it's in the middle of kind of a middle-class community, very nice community, Chula Vista. It started in 1897 in a park, all sand greens, and it had to move because they were building a big exposition coming to San Diego shortly after the turn of the century. And then they moved over to Point Loma in San Diego, and then they got moved again in 1920 because the Navy was going to move their Naval Training Center to San Diego. They had moved out of San Francisco area. And then in 1921, they built this course. It was designed by William Watson, who before that had designed U.S. Open courses, Interlaken, which is where Bobby Jones won his U.S. Open in 1930. Olympia Fields he designed before that. And 3 years after he built San Diego Country Club, he designed Olympic Club in San Francisco. And actually the two courses, they have two courses there, the lake and the ocean course.
Right.
So, yeah. So he was a well-known architect that had moved to Los Angeles, did a lot of great courses in the area, Hacienda and Hillcrest, lots of really good golf courses that are still there and still, you know, very well known. And San Diego was looking for water. San Diego Country Club was looking for water, and they found well water in the south end of the town. And the other thing that was good, in 1921, Prohibition was in effect and would be for another few years. And it was only 7 miles from the Mexican border. So they thought, wow, what a great idea. We could play golf here and go down and watch highlight matches and have a couple of drinks before we go back home. And that's what they did.
So, is there a lot of elevation change? I'm sorry, is there a lot of elevation change in the golf course?
It is hilly, and it was all built by horse and plow, so the fairways all are hilly and bumpy and pretty cool. I mean, it's just a really neat vision with all the hills and bumps and contouring on the greens, and it's a very easy course to walk, and the greens and tees are close together to each other, and, of course, the weather in San Diego is always great, so you can pretty much play year-round at any time. So it's a great experience. And over the years, lots of great golfers have been to the club. Ben Hogan played there, and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby came many years ago in a program, a charity program called Save a Heart. And it was during their heyday when they were doing a lot of movies together, and they got in all kinds of big pros to come and play, and they raised about $500,000 in charity to be able to help people get a heart transplant, back when that was just starting to happen. So a lot of really neat history. The very first San Diego Opens, which are now played over in Torrey Pines, and they're called right now, it's called the Farmers Insurance Open. Before that, it was the Buick Invitational. But that the first two were held at San Diego Country Club, 1952 and 1953. And our member, young member then, was Billy Casper. He was serving in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War. And so he got to play and actually made the cut. So that was kind of exciting for the local fans back then.
Interesting history. I'm curious about the age of the women. At what point do they get to go from being a junior golfer to being a woman's? Get classified
really,
as women.
Yeah, that's kind of a really neat thing. There's no age limit to play in the U.S. Women's Amateur, even though there's you can only be up, I think, through 17 to play in the junior. But in the women's amateur, any age can play, and like the junior girls champion gets an invite to play in the women's am. And but it's interesting. I saw a stat, and it's in the slides, a stat from a couple of years ago, and it said out of 156 players, 99 of them are ages 14 to 19. And
wow,
and 51 or 20 to 24, and there were two players who are 50 years or older. So probably the senior women's amateur champion that gets an invitation and the previous year's player were the two oldest players. And Ellen Port has a great history. I don't know if you've heard her name, but she still is a top winner in senior women's amateur golf, and she's played in probably more championships than anybody, run by the USGA. Pretty amazing lady. So it's, so you get a lot of young players, which is probably a good thing because they're still thinking about college education, and a lot of them are getting scholarships. and they're excited about this is maybe a stepping stone for professional golf, but a lot of them stay amateur, which is great. And so it's a great mix of players that come.
Very interesting.
We have two players from our club, and I have a picture of them in the slides. And their last name is Whiston, and Waverly and Nicole, and they both are big winners on the Junior Golf Association, AJGA Tour, and I think it was Nicole was in the quarterfinals of the girls junior last year, and she's now just accepted a scholarship at the University of Tennessee. But it's an example of these are two players that play at our club, and they're both just terrific players. I hope they qualify. They're both going to try to qualify. They don't have a free exemption.
They have an unfair advantage knowing the course as well as they do, right?
Well, that's only if they get there.
Yeah,
they still have to go somewhere to qualify. I think in their case, they're going to go up to a club called Red Hill, and they've never seen it before. So, at this point, so you know, it makes it difficult. Let's say you've got a field of 60 or 80 players, and they're maybe playing for five spots. It's going to be pretty competitive, and they've got to get past that.
Well, all of it is just fascinating history. I'm just really appreciate you giving us not only the inside look as to how a major USGA event takes place, what it take, what is involved to put it together financially and logistically. That's fascinating. So I really, I think it's so interesting. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us. And good luck to you.
Thank you, Fred. Yeah, thanks.
I hope it's a great event, and I hope you get a lot of people showing up. Thanks again, Dean. It was great to talk to you, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Fred.
Hey, very excited, because next week we're going to talk to Jim Cowan, the Director of Course Rating and Handicap for the Northern California Golf Association. This is a topic that has confused me for the entire time I've been playing golf, which is, what tee boxes do I hit from? Do I use yardage in the scorecard, or I'd look at rating and slope? I mean, these are things that we keep asking forever, and we still really don't know the answer. So what Jim's going to help us with is what rating, slope, and total yardage means as far as the amateur golfer and how to choose a proper tee box for your game. We'll also find out if it's how it's determined which hole is ranked number one handicap hole on the course, and number nine, number 18. It's sometimes you like, really, this is the hardest handicap hole? Is that what that means? Well, you'll be surprised. So if you've never understood which tees to hit from, or why your scores are so much different from different tees, and why you shouldn't play from the tips, this episode's going to really help you. Now remember, Golf Smarter Premium Access is no longer available, and that means that all Golf Smarter episodes, all 597, are now free for everyone. So if you'd like to listen to Golf Smarter more than once a week, this is your chance. You can go back in the archives and hear stuff that are going to help your game today. I promise. So please check it out. Golf Smarter. And the easiest way to access all these episodes is by downloading the free Golf Smarter app for either iOS or Android. But of course, you can subscribe for free in iTunes, the Apple Podcasts app, Overcast, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please follow at Golf Smarter on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Or if you'd like to ask me directly, just click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.